Let me start out by trying to explain what the banking system is. And we'll do this with our economics class if we can. And explain how banks operate. The other day I was talking to a vice president of one of the large banks of California, and he said he asked the president of his bank to explain to him the International Monetary Fund, because he didn't. The president says, I can't figure it out either. Now, he says, is this something when the president of a very large bank can't explain the International Monetary Fund? In fact, it is difficult to find out what the International Monetary Fund is all about. And if you ever got a head full of gobbledygook, you can't figure out anything. The textbooks kind of run over with a bunch of platitudes, but things seem to be quite mysterious about banking and Federal Reserve and what happens to money and depression and inflation and all these other sorts of things. Let me explain it this way, you will let me. I am a grain elevator operator. That is, I have an elevator and people store grain in my elevator. Now, this man comes to put the 100,000 bushels of grain in my elevator. What does he want from me? He wants me to give him a receipt so he can show that he owns 100,000 bushels of wheat in my elevator, doesn't he? So I issue him a wheat receipt to say 100,000 bushels. And this man puts in 20,000, 10,000, 15,000, 18,000. Different people put out grain in my elevator. Some people, they take out an elevator, but they store grain there. Now, what do I find? What happens is that he finds out that he can go out and take his elevator receipt, his wheat receipt, and he can buy things with it. He can change it for things, so he can sell it on the market. They do that in the grain set, don't they, in the grain market. They buy and sell what? Wheat? No, they buy and sell receipts for wheat, don't they? Now, that's the grain market. So I run my elevator, and I notice something about my elevator. People bring wheat, take out wheat. Sometimes I have a million bushels. Sometimes I have 800,000 bushels. Sometimes I have 600,000 bushels. But I never have less than 300,000 bushels. People are bringing and selling it, and coming and going all the time. But there's always 300,000 bushels. That's the minimum ever in my elevator. One day I want to build a little tight. My wife needs a new fur coat or something like this. I'm going to go down the bank and buy them 10 interest on it. I say, wait a minute, I don't need to really pay interest. I can do something else. What if I would write up a receipt for 10,000 bushels of wheat and sell the receipt? Now, if the person wanted the wheat, I got 300,000 bushels. It wouldn't know the difference. One wheat looks like any other wheat, doesn't it? So I saw and later I'll buy the 10,000 bushels back when I have the money, buy the receipt back for 10,000 bushels, tear it up, and we'll all be easy. And I won't have to pay any interest. Isn't that smart? Sure. So I issue such a receipt. I write one, I go out and sell it. Now, what happens? I never really had to buy that receipt back because I never down to 10,000 bushels. Now, pretty soon the wife wants to live in a little bigger house. Well, I write another little receipt for another 20,000 bushels a week. Then I write another little receipt for another thing. Pretty soon the church needs a little money, so I give them 5,000 bushels a week receipt. Go out and sell. And I'm a big shot. The mayor has me on the council and the commission. I'm on all the boards. Everybody knows that I'm a successful businessman. I got the biggest car in town. My children you look up to, the families look up to. We have a respectable, dignified name. Right? I am a successful businessman. And everybody looks to me as one of the finest. I have good money for the charity, little kids, the charity for the school program and the whole works, right? I am Mr. Knight. But back in my office, when I closed the door, I sit there and I worry. Why? Some months, because I've written so many receipts now, I've only got 4,000 and 5,000 bushels of wheat in the back room. And there's $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 of bushels of receipts going around. And if too many people come in and ask for their receipts at once, people will find out I'm a cheat. I'm real worried. Sure, I'm a big shock to the world. You know, we can all kid the world, can't we? But back in that back room, we sit there and we're putting our names. What happens if they ask for more wheat than I got? I get real worried. Bad idea. I go down the track and I see old Joe. Joe runs the wheat elevator down there. I say, hey, Joe, you and I are in trouble. What do you mean we're in trouble? I've had a successful business. Now, look, Joe, you're doing the same thing I did. You're getting more wheat receipts than our wheat. I wouldn't do a thing. I look, Joe, don't kid. I look, we're in trouble. Yeah, we sure are. Now, if people find out I've written wheat receipts without wheat, they're going to suspect you. And if everybody comes in and asks for their wheat, you can't back your wheat receipts any better than I can back mine. If they catch you, they're going to come after me. You know who the dirty people are? The people who would run on us and ask for their wheat. Those are the bad people. Now look what would happen. Look, Joe, if they come and ask for their wheat and we can't get the wheat, all those people who hold those wheat receipts will lose out. Sure, we'll be ruined, but they'll be ruined too, wouldn't they? They find a wheat receipt and buy it in full faith, and they're going to find out that wheat receipt's no good, and they'll be disastrous.
Everybody will lose. It'd be terrible for everybody, wouldn't it? Therefore, it is our civic duty to see that they don't find out we wrote phony weaknesses. You see, as long as they don't know they're phony, they're just as good as real weaknesses. People buy and sell them and think they're worth value, as long as they think they're worth value. What difference does it make? Now, that man's rationalizing, isn't it? Huh? Okay. That's all right. So do it. Look, there's only one way out of this. Let's hold a little convention of all the fleet elevator operators in our valley, and we're going to get them all together. Are we getting together? Gentlemen, we've all been writing some phony wheat receipts. Oh, no. Look. Let's get out all of the holier now bit and get down to classical problems. Now, we've all been writing these wheat receipts. I know there's a lot more wheat receipts routing around than real wheat. Every one of you are in business because you've been doing the same thing I'm doing, because if you weren't doing it, I would have beaten you out long ago. The only way you survive is the same way I survive, writing wheat receipts for the wheat that isn't there. Now, you know how terrible it would be if the people found out we've been writing bad wheat receipts. There would be wipe out thousands of innocent people who hold our wheat receipts right now. We've got to protect those innocent people from finding out we're cheap. Now, where's the face back? We can't hide a wheat receipt back. We can't make it straight. Even we wanted to, we simply haven't got it. We spent it. See, we can't buy it back. The only practical thing to do is keep them from finding out the wheat receipts are no good. Now, what we're going to have to do is we are going to each put 50,000 bushels of wheat into one central elevator so that if anybody gets too low, he can come and draw the wheat and cover his wheat receipt so nobody finds out that he's cheating. That's called our Community Wheat Insurance Corporation. All right? Now, we're going to have to do another little thing, see? Some of you people with this nice new insurance corporation, which will guarantee that you are not going to have to be in default, will think that you're so protected you will keep by writing even more receipts. What we're going to do is make an agreement amongst us that we will work, pull together, and elect a trust that is our representative to a super organization which will control how many phony wheat receipts we write, so that we all cheat equally. Otherwise, some of you will cheat more than others. And we're also going to have to stabilize the price of wheat receipts, so that those people who cheat less than others, the wheat receipts don't go for different values in the market, which would show some of us out. In other words, we're going to... Now, look, how can we do this? I know some of you guys are going to cheat. Because you're as good a guy as I am, see? I know just what you're like. Yes, you are. Now, what we're going to do, see Bill over here? Bill's looking for a job. Now, if we elected Bill governor, Bill promises to pass a law saying that we can set up a monopoly control trust to guarantee that we'll regulate wheat receipt writings. And that all wheat receipt writings will have to be official wheat receipts. And wheat receipts will have to be accepted by people as real wheat receipts, whether they are or not. Legal wheat receipts. Legal tender wheat receipts. We are going to force people to have to accept them as real wheat receipts, whether they are or not. They can't question the wheat receipt anymore. And they've got to recognize our monopoly on wheat receipt writing so new phony people can't come in and write wheat receipts and pass them like there are wheat receipts. Not only that, he promised to pass a law that anybody who makes a copy of our phony wheat receipts will go to jail as a counterfeiter. He's counterfeiting wheat receipts, isn't he? Only the members of our monopoly association can write phony wheat receipts. This is for the good of the people, because if there are too many phony wheat receipts around, people get suspicious. We've got to keep new wheat receipt writers out of the business. And the second thing is, we've got to make sure that people cannot call for the wheat receipt. So after a few years, this goes along, and people get used to this sort of thing. And of course, remember, who are the bad people in bank runs? Why, the people who come in and ask for their money back. The people who run on a bank are the people who are bad, aren't they? They are causing lack of faith. Our textbooks tell us the bad people are the people who ask for their money that they deposited in good faith, aren't they? Because they cause bank crashes that hurt everybody. Why? The bank can't pay. Why? They don't have it. Why? That's interesting, isn't it? Well, let's go back and I'll take a look at something else. After a few years, people get used to these nice new official looking wheat receipts. They can't get wheat bought. We passed the law now. Look, what would happen if people in general asked wheat receipts for everybody? Sure, we can have a central wheat pool. We transfer wheat back and forth to keep one person getting caught. What if everybody would ask for wheat receipts, or a lot of people in many banks at once? we might not be able to deliver enough reproduction. What are we going to do? Old Joe is still up there. It only costs us 0.5% in order to finance a good election campaign to make sure the right guy is making the right law. So we have to make a new law. It is illegal for people to have wheat with a wheat receipt. Now, there's wheat receipts, and there's wheat there, but you can't have any wheat. It's illegal for anybody to hold wheat unless they are a member of the association. Now, members of our association can hold wheat, but nobody else can have it. You understand that? That is to keep these awful people from asking for more wheat than there is. How could they ask for more wheat than there is if we had the wheat behind every wheat receipt? Well, they couldn't. But what if there are more wheat receipts than there's wheat? That's the only way you could ever be a run on wheat receipts, right? And so to protect against a run, we got to make sure that people can't have wheat. But now we've got to be honorable about this thing. We've got to give wheat to other members of the association. You see, you're going to have to pay off to club members in real wheat. But you don't pay off to non-club members. They can't own wheat. Only the licensed members of the association, right? Right? Call the Federal Wheat Reserve Board. Of course, we do this to stabilize the wheat receipts to protect everybody from unstable wheat markets. Know it? Sure. Well, after a few years, people get used to not getting wheat for their wheat receipts. We'll make a new deal. 1968. We won't be required to have any wheat behind our wheat receipts. We'll say that a wheat receipt is the same thing as wheat. And there is no need to have wheat anymore. We can take all the wheat. And what you can get for a wheat receipt, we guarantee to redeem every wheat receipt with another wheat receipt. That's like going into a parking lot, you're taking your parking ticket, you know, you put your ticket, ticket for your parked car, and you go in and you say, I want my car is number so-and-so, if I'm taking it, they say, sorry, we sold your car, but we'd be happy to give you another receipt. You can have a blue parking ticket or a green parking ticket, what color ticket do you want? Well, I want my car back. Oh, no, we sold your car. Now, look, if you have a Chevrolet car, we'll give you a blue Buick parking ticket. How's that? Or you go down to the Green Stamp Redemption Center, and they tell you, for your green stamp, we'll give you a nice new book of green stamps, the old book of green stamps. You say, well, I would like a prize. Well, I'm sorry, we aren't getting prizes, but we will redeem your green stamps in green paint. Right? Well, we have this little club going, we have a problem. We've got to make sure the people in other associations and other valleys, in order for our wheat receipts still to appear good. When people in our associations and other valleys, we promise to give them wheat for our wheat receipts that they hold, because they got their crops. If they'll give us wheat for their wheat receipts that we hold. In other words, amongst other monopoly clubs, we will give wheat and redeem. But we will not do it to people in our own club area who aren't members of the association. Well, there's a problem. People outside of our club area, some people get those wheat receipts, and they keep demanding wheat. And our wheat gets lower and lower and lower. So we now go to a dual market. Other Monopoly Club members can get wheat, but no one else can get any wheat, whether they're in our club area or anywhere else. There's still a problem left involved. What is that problem? Some of the other Monopoly wheat areas keep giving wheat for their receipts and show up our wheat receipts, which won't exchange the same value. People prefer their wheat receipts over ours. Those are bad people. They're upsetting the intra-community wheat market. There are other people who, valleys, which have their monopoly associations, which will not redeem their wheat receipts even for us when we hold them. That is, they have soft wheat receipts. They won't redeem it to the monopoly association. How are you going to have to get rid of that? We're going to have to merge all the monopolies into one monopoly and have one worldwide wheat association reserve board called the International Wheat Fund. Right? Then all wheat receipts will be equally full. And the market, the wheat market, will be now stabilized and there can be no run anywhere. The only way to have ultimate assurance and protection is to have a wheat, world wheat monopoly control board. Now, I hope you understand what the International Monetary Fund is all about. What it is simply all about is they stole your money. Now, you see, I got a piece of paper here. It isn't even printed by the United States. It isn't an American note. It isn't a dollar, a United States dollar. It is a Federal Reserve note. Notice, the Federal Reserve is not owned by the United States government. It is a privately owned bank. The private bank, this is my up in Minnesota here last year, a man was arrested for drawing pictures just like these pictures. They brought him into court and called him a counterfeiter. He was found not guilty when he proved that he was willing to redeem his piece of paper for exactly what the Federal Reserve was willing to redeem your piece of paper. Now he says, if I gave less than the Federal Reserve, I would be writing a phony claim. See, the Federal Reserve promises to give nothing. Theirs is a claim on nothing, and mine's a claim on nothing. I am doing no different than the Federal Reserve is doing. He's acquitted. Fraud is to write a claim on something that is a bogus. He didn't write a claim on anything. He just happened to draw pictures like the Federal Reserve was drawing pictures. They just looked all right. How could there be a crime involved? Interesting, huh? Now, let's take a look at another little thing.
All right.
Illustration two.
All right.
There's a thing called a pawn shop. I hope you understand what a pawn shop is. It is a bank. It's a foreman bank. When you go down to buy that bank, the interest rate is high. Why? The cost of making a loan is the same. The time involved and everything else. The guy would put the loan $100,000, you're only $25. If you're only $25, the guy makes 10 loans a day, he's got to earn enough of the 10 loans to live on, doesn't he? So, relative to the $25, the cost is high. But actually, the pawn shop earns less per loan than a bank earns, right? So a lot of people think the pawn shop is bad because their interest rate is high. No, that's just because the loans are small. The smaller the loan, the higher the interest rate's got to be to cover the cost of making the loan. Well, what is a pawn shop? A pawn shop is a foreman's bank. He goes in, he puts up his coat, his collateral, or his watch, right? And he gets $25 a year. Why does a pawnbroker want his coat or watch? Very simple. He doesn't want to pay back. The pawnbroker's got to have a way to get even. How does he get even? He sells the coat or watch, doesn't he? To get the money back, and the guy doesn't come in and pay off the pawn. He doesn't pay what he promised him. Now, notice, the Savings Loan Association loans you money for your house. They want a mortgage on your house. If you don't pay the payments, they're going to come and take your house. Huh? Now, if you go down and borrow on your car to a finance company, they loan you money, make an agreement, right? But they want a chattel mortgage on your car. You don't pay, they come with a tow rope and haul your car away. If you're a businessman and you want to borrow, you go down to the commercial bank and they loan you, but they want a little lien on your inventory, a little lien on your receivables, they want some way to get the money back. Kind of funny, isn't it? Notice, if you're in the business of lending, you've got to have a way of collecting your money back. Don't you? Well, you're not in it very long. What would happen if you lend money on cars and said, I didn't want any cattle mortgage or anything else, and I wouldn't tow your car away if you didn't pay? How long do you think you'd be in the finance business? Well, about 5 weeks until all your money was gone, and then that'd be the end of that. Now, notice something else. The finance company does not want to tow your car away. The savings loan company doesn't want to foreclose on your house. They will if they answer. Why? Because if they don't, no one's going to pay. But they don't want to foreclose. They want you to pay. They want you to pay, you promise. They're not in the business of foreclosing. Let's notice something else. The Savings and Loan Association, nor the finance company, any of them ever really want you to pay back. If you pay back for your car, what do they want to do? They want to lend you on another car. Their job isn't to get their money back, but to keep you in debt to collect interest. That's what they're in business for. A bank doesn't lend money to a business that they think is going to pay back and not borrow anymore. They lend to a business they know is going to grow and need more and more money, become a better and better customer, borrow more and more money, pay more and more interest. That's what they're in the business for, not getting their money back, but keeping it out working. Okay? Now, if there is a borrower, there is a lender. If there's a lender, there's a borrower. If we find anybody borrowing, then somebody is lending. Okay? I mean, it has to be simple. Can't be that. If government's borrowed, there must be somebody who lends the government. Some people would call the people who lend the government international financiers. Or other sorts of names. International bank, all sorts of names. But there's somebody who lends to government. These people are leading for choir practice. And what do they mean by lending to government? We are told by our schools that we owe the national debt to ourselves. So, but do we? Does everybody in the United States own $2,000 worth of bonds? It has to, if we owe it to ourselves. Now, if somebody has $4,000 worth of bonds and somebody else has none, then the one who has two to none owes $2,000 to the one who has $4,000. Look at that question. Now, some people own way more than $2,000 worth of bonds, and most people own way less than $2,000 worth of government, federal government bonds. Don't talk about federal, not state, local, and everything else. We don't owe it to ourselves. We owe it to somebody else. Let's make that clear. Unless you happen to have a big pile of government bonds. Now, how do we... Let's get this up front. If you loan to a government, if you loan to a king, one of the oldest games of kings is lending, spending more money than they take in a tank. They first flip the coin of the realm. That's the first game they go into. And after the coins only float and they no longer sink anymore, then they start printing paper money. But that starts inflating. They find that they have to finance their little game by another little thing. It's called debt. Borrow. Now, if they can borrow from their people, they have already taxed it. If you're going to borrow to finance government, you've got to borrow from somebody who's got enough money to finance government. The problem with a person who lends to government is how do you collect? How do you foreclose if he doesn't pay? You go into the king and say, hey, you didn't pay me all my money. I demand my money. The king might say, off with your head. Now, that's kind of a dangerous way to lend, isn't it? Simple economics. So what are you going to do? You've got to have a way of throwing away his kingdom if he doesn't pay. Now, how do you throw away a cat with a cat? With another cat. How do you throw away a kingdom? With another kingdom. Now, that's simple. We call it, in ordinary everyday language, war. That's kingdom toll. All right? Now, I can't lend to one kingdom without lending to the kingdom's enemy. I got to make sure the two kingdoms are enemies of each other and about equal size and strength so that my lending makes a difference of who wins in case of conflict. And so the King A knows that King B can whomp him if I'm the King B. And King B knows that King A and I can whomp him. So now I have the power over both King A and King B. I don't have the power over both King A and King B. I'm not in the finance business. Because if I can't tow the car away, I'm out of business. Let's make it quick. Let's take a little history. Back in 1762, a man named Mayor Rothschild started out a little banking house. He had five sons. There was a monopoly set up going on in Europe at that time. Napoleon, a man who mysteriously rose to power, wasn't even a Frenchman, put on a continental policy. Nobody could import into Europe anything by law of Napoleon. The English government, the enemy of Napoleon, put a blockade around Napoleon. No one could ship to Napoleon. Obviously, there couldn't be no shipping. But only one family was allowed in broad daylight to run both the French and the British blockade and run the ships from England and anywhere in the world into Holland and deliver goods at fantastically high prices because of the monopoly established by both governments with Nathan Rothschild in England and his brothers on the continent distributing the goods. They became extremely wealthy. In 1815, Nathan Rothschild in England, at the Battle of Waterloo, received the news 2 hours before anybody else of who won, or maybe he even knew before then. But he started selling publicly government bonds. The government would obviously be financially collapsed if Napoleon won at Waterloo. If Wellington won, the bonds were good. But publicly, Nathan Rothschild started selling government bonds, British government council, and he started selling them in a panic. To get rid of them, surely to get rid of them at any price. The price would sell and sell and sell. In 2 hours, they fell 95%. And he had all of his agents buying the bonds, and everybody else rushed to sell theirs. And in 10 minutes, he mocked the British government. Not bad, a little operation for an afternoon, you know. In 1820, when the French government was financing itself through a new bond issue, all the French bankers were invited in by the king. And Napoleon, or Louis Rothschild, who built himself a little house exactly like Versailles, was sitting out in the anteroom because he wasn't invited. Louis Rothschild was sitting there in his white ermine garments with his big coach and 12 white horses and everything out there and all his liverymen. He was sitting out in the anteroom. In a few minutes, people started scurrying in and out of the town. The French bond market had just collapsed. And Rothschild was sitting out there, delivering his thumbs, and the King of France comes out and bows to Louis Rothschild and invites him in. And Louis Rothschild bows to the government of France. Solomon Rothschild is on to Vienna. He is financing his friend and the partner, Prince Metternich, who are running the Holy Roman Empire, Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, what is now that whole area. He couldn't even own property in Austria. He just owned the government. and the emperor. Which was bad, little boy. You're trying to make good. What about Calman Rothschild, the youngest boy? Oh, he arrived kind of late, but he arrived down in Naples. Opened up the Rothschild Bank in Naples. Within a few years, he had every kingdom in Italy, which, remember, was not a nation yet. So heavily in debt to him, including one little kingdom called the Vatican. In fact, he had the Vatican so in debt to him by 1842 that Calman Rothschild ordered the Pope to invite him to the Vatican and say his kosher in public at a public banquet. Which was rather humiliating. Particularly when the Pope got up and fancied that he was referred to Rome as the Holy City. Calman got up and said, Jerusalem is the Holy City. Which didn't help the Pope at all. Because you know, there are times we can't say anything, it's so-called diplomacy. What about Ishmael, the oldest son, sitting up on Frankfurt on the Main? Well, Ishmael, modest, nice, young German count, a baron, actually, who was a young, ambitious fellow, wanted to go somewhere. He's a fairly bright boy, so he took his little boy in and financed his little kid. The man's name was Otto von Bismarck, the Iron Chancellor, the man who wailed at himself Germany. They did pretty good. Now notice, in Europe, after every war, how there had to be two powers, groups of powers of equal size, called balance of power. Why? We gotta make sure all from A can be threatened by King B, and B by A. But you need somebody on the outside to change the power. What was that? England, Nathan Rothschild in England, and you have Louis in France, and Solomon in Austria. Notice the center of every militant group, or the coalition, was Vienna and Paris. With Nathan Rothschild in England staying on the outside as the whip saw which way the thing was to go. You could watch which way the victor was going to be in every war, by which way England went. The problem was, when the game came up in 1914, England wasn't enough to throw the battle. So they got a new one, called the United States, to do England's role. Well, anyway, notice you've got to have a way of flexing. You also got to have government debt if you're going to get money away. Notice, a man belonged to a very wealthy club back in 1840. This club made up of the most wealthy and powerful people in Europe, called the League of Gentlemen, and had two very, of which now are famous people. At that time, they were practically unknown. They were just small members of this. They were really kind of the cloakroom boys, named Frederick Engels and Karl Marx. Engels and Marx wrote a book, which they were hired to write by the club, the League of Gentlemen, which later changed its name to the Brotherhood of Communists, to write a book of the necessity, what's the second plank of the platform, of a progressive personal individual income tax, and the necessity of a central bank. Why? You need a central bank to be able to collect the money from the government legally. And you need an income tax to collect it legally from the people. Notice the income tax was passed to take it away from the rich and give to the poor. Now, I give the Internal Revenue testimony before the United States Senate in 1969 on the Internal Revenue Act. One day he said that in 1968, those people earning more than $20 million than that year paid less than 7% income tax. Those people earning over $600,000 paid no taxes whatsoever. 85% of the entire personal income tax came from the lowest tax bracket. It's not taxless and get it full. There are 100,000 tax-free foundations that pay no tax. These foundations, let's take the Rockefeller and the Ford and the Carnegie Foundation, with their fabulous millions, support the left-wing schools of the United States. In fact, the schools of education teaching the teachers, the 20 largest schools in the United States in the last 50 years have received over half their entire endowment from two, the Carnegie and the Rockefeller Foundation. Therefore, what these kids are learning today is what they want them to learn. What is that? We need a Federal Reserve to stabilize. We need government control of the money system to stop depression. We have to have the Federal Reserve Bank is next to God, isn't it? And they're taught that in the school. But look at something. You take any income textbook and what does it do? It spends almost all of its time trying to show you how to prevent the business cycle and the cause of the business cycle. But I will tell you the cause, and I can do it by saying to you right now 300 pages of reading. The only cause of the business cycle, it's the change in the availability of credit. And availability of credit is changed by the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve is owned by the banks, not the government. I will show you something else. I was over the other day, a chief economist of a large bank in the United States, had me over 3 nights ago over at his home. He said, I have a very startling piece of information. And I looked at it, I said, I've been saying this all along. It's nice to have your chart to verify. That is that every business cycle is never stopped by the Federal Reserve. Notice they always make a mistake, the timing is off on flight and lose money. But if you will check, their timing is perfect if you want to assume that they create the business cycle. They tighten money, and a bust happens. They loosen it, and prosperity happens. Now watch something. If I was the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, and I knew we were going in there, we're going to pass some tight money, would I hold my own personal stock? Or would I sell them, knowing the market's going to go down? If I knew we were going to go pass loose money policy, I know the market's going up, right? Would I be so stupid as not to buy stock? Now notice, if I had that information, I have to get rid of it. I don't see the governor getting poor. They get rich. Now there's some other people who get richer. For example, here is Rocky, who got me my job on the board of governors, and we're having dinner. What I say to Rocky says, how do you think the market's going to go? What I say, all right, when I know we just passed tight money today. Or would I say, I would think it wouldn't be advisable to hold too much stock right now. I mean, just as a friend. Wouldn't you tell a friend what you felt the market was going to build if he asked you? Those people who are friends would get richer. How do you keep this little system where those certain people know? For example, this man was telling me, the vice president of the bank, but his offices are right below the Lehman Brothers, who are real insiders in the New York. And a week before, he said, talking to Ball, George Ball of the State Department, he's now back with Lehman Brothers. And Ball was saying, well, you're out of stock, aren't you? And he said, what do you mean I'm out of stock? He said, don't you know about Cambodia? This is a week before Cambodia. Sure, they all were out. Why? Certain people get the advance news or give the orders. Where did Nixon live 4 years before he became president? In Rockefeller's apartment building in New York, $100,000 apartment covering the whole floor. Where did he work? For a law firm whose major client is Standard Oil. Who do you think he says yes, sir, to? Rockefeller established in 1919 an organization called the Council of Foreign Relations. We have some interesting members of this little club. Not only the Rockefellers, but every president of the Federal Reserve Board. In his history, Thomas Dewey, Adlai Stevenson, Dwight David Eisenhower, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Richard Milhouse Nixon, Hubert Horatio Humphrey. You can have people that can tweedle duck, right? You go down the polls and think you vote, you decide prosperity, depression. You decide these things by voting once every 4 years, and that's your city duty, you cut. Look at even when Humphrey wins, Nixon wins. Now when Nixon won, Kennedy won. If you don't happen to vote the way the newspapers have told you that they control, the school teachers who've been turned out of their factories to support the idea of a controlled economy, I'll tell you something. There is nothing in the economy to cause a business cycle outside of the Federal Reserve. Without the Federal Reserve, you couldn't have a depression. In 1923 and 28, the Federal Reserve was making money plentiful. They increased the amount of loans on stock alone from $2 billion to $10 billion, just under $10 billion, and inflated the whole stock market. Then what did they do in the spring of 1929? They started tightening their money. Notice, by March, when our broker sold out, in June, the Rockefellers were out. In July, the Kennedys were out. They ride down the line, and all of them, the Lehmans were out, everybody else was out, and the money is tightening and tightening, and the crash comes. And while the crash was on, remember, the Federal Reserve was supposed to make money available to everybody, and why were the banks closing? Why were the little country banks who weren't members of the big club in New York closing? But Chase Manhattan, the largest bank, bought by John D. Rockefeller in 1904, didn't close. New York City Bank, the second biggest bank in New York, bought by William Rockefeller in 1904, didn't close. Could there be something? Here you see that Hall of Fame is going to take away Rockefeller's millions and give it to the poor. He doesn't put his money in the Birch Society. In fact, Rockefeller puts his money in the left wing, doesn't he? He puts it in the school, turn up country, and hates the free enterprise system. Why? He hates the free enterprise system. The enemy of him is a competitor. You notice when one of those poor boys like Teddy Roosevelt got elected to fight the monopoly. Did the monopolies become less or more? Did the big businesses become less or more? You see, in the 1900s, small businesses were popping up everywhere, weren't they? Competition against the big businesses were everywhere. Everybody could go into business. Everybody wants. And every town, sure, Standard Oil would come in and dump oil and wipe you out, right? But what happened? The day they raised the price and wiped you out, you went back in business again. It wouldn't work. They had to get Teddy in there to start setting up the legal monopoly, the regulations, the controls, and how much oil could be pumped under conservation. So that you couldn't get a license to pump oil while Standard Oil could. What do you think conservation programs are for? Only those people with a license can do it. What about crop control, wheat control, cotton control? Why? You don't get a license, your land is worthless, is it? You can't grow cotton unless you get a government certificate. The people in the know get the certificate. The people financing to give the right money to the right party, the right candidate, get the certificate. You play ball, you get the certificate. So if you don't, you don't get a certificate. But how do you get this, keep this whole game going? You could never get off with it unless you had government schools, which were financed, not by the parents, not willingly, but the money was taken by force. And so the teacher does not teach what the parents want, but teaches what the state wants. And if you think the state is independent, it is not. People say, well, what about in England? When the wealthy, when the big banks were nationalized, well, you'd think that they lost out, wouldn't you? Unless the people of the big banks owned the government, then all they really did is merge in their competitors' banks and own the whole shooting range. If you think of the government as an independent agency, then they lost. If the government is a holding company, then they won. You see, there's some different theories. Theory that the Federal Reserve fights depression, or theory it causes depression. Evidence supports strongly the latter. We have a theory that inflation is supposed to be caused by wage-price spirals, isn't it? I want to tell you something. I've had 11 years of economics. I'm going to give you a little clue. I'm going to calculate it right in a matter of a minute, because that's about all we have. We'll talk a couple minutes. All the workers can strike all they want, and they can't get a wage increase unless the businesses can pay. No matter how brutal a strike is, no company can get into it unless they can pay the wage increase. The company can't get in unless they can get an increase in their customers. The customer can't pay them unless there's an increase in the money supply so that they can pay the higher price. Second, if there is an increase in the money supply, the customers will bid against each other and force prices up. Which, well, labor will demand a bigger share of and will go on strike. Labor and business don't cause inflation. Increase of the money supply does. See, neither business nor labor can cause inflation because they can't increase the money supply. Only the government or the central bank can cause inflation. All inflation is caused by the central bank. The blame, however, is never taken by the central bank. Why? They endowed the schools to teach the teachers, to teach your kids that it was business and labor. Why? So they're going to be wage and price control to control the producers of a nation, every bread earner in this country, to fight inflation. Because they've been writing too many phony wheat receipts. But it's your fault. You people want higher wages just because the prices go up. It's your fault. You people raise your prices because your customers are willing to pay more. You're the dirty people. Not the people who are spending more money. We're given a con game. But Satan is the father of lies. Right? And that's the world system. You worship the world system, you're going to get taken. You see, the one thing that a con artist needs is you have to believe he's a con artist. And believe that he's straight up. The one thing the con artist needs is the ability to give you all your information so you don't get it from anywhere else. Somebody else might tell you the truth. That's why they tell you, don't listen to these people, don't listen to those, and don't join this, and don't get involved in that, and watch out by these radicals, these extremists, these fundamentalists, and all these other things, right? So they might give you a different point of view, and that would be dangerous. And they spent a lot of time building a lot of schools and doing a lot of conniving to get a system to indoctrinate you on radio, television, newspapers, and hammer you in the schools and get the textbooks and everything else, all pointing to one thing. How wonderful the government is, how it's trying to solve all your needs and your problems, how they're managing the money in order to keep you from losing, how they're taking away your money to take care of your old age, only you pay four times the Social Security, but any private company will sell you the same insurance policy for. They're rated 400% in the United States government. for Medicare, what you pay for Medicare, which gives you a hospital bed without a doctor at the age of 65, a private insurance company, you need to start paying the rate at 18, will write you a policy to give you a doctor and a hospital bed and cover you from the age 25 for the rest of your life. How does the government sell that kind of insurance? You gotta buy it, go to jail. What a pity. How many salesmen will love that pitch? Any insurance salesman would sure love to sell that insurance, huh? You can't miss. Sign up everyone. You notice it's all force and deception. You see, there are only two concepts of government. By the way, I just give you a preview. These are little excerpts out of my favorite Saturday talk. That's why my wife wasn't going to say, well, I just take something out of my talk. Here we go, talking about this, it links in a whole series of things, the political concepts, and social concepts, and educational concepts, and what the whole program of the civil rights are about, and what the whole program of the peace things, and what the campuses are doing, and what the program is to do with the mind. Why? The people who've been writing the Wheatley piece don't want you to call them. Let me finish up with just one other little example, comes to my mind, maybe I can jam it in here, just have a short one. How does federal debt come about? Let's see if I can do it in your mind. It's a little difficult. I don't have a blackboard here. The government takes a piece of paper and writes a bond. I owe you $100,000. That's called a bond. It's an IOU. They sell it to the Federal Reserve. Wait a minute. Do they sell it to the Federal Reserve? Well, they give the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve opens up a bank account and allows the government to write checks on accounts that didn't fail. And what does the Federal Reserve use to back up this new bank account that they just invented? Oh, the bond that was just invented is the asset to cover the liability of the new bank account they just invented. So the security against the bank account is the bond that they just wrote, okay? Now, the government writes checks and gives it to people, don't they? Those people think it's their money. They go down, put it in the bank, and make that binding thing. Notice this money came out of nowhere, didn't it? Now there's more money, but no more good. The government didn't produce any. So the extra money chases the existing goods, what happens? The price of all existing goods must go up enough to absorb all the damage by a high. I won't explain that to you. It's too complicated, but there's a multiplier. The bond will apply to citizens, there's no inflation. But private citizens don't buy all the debt. In fact, they only buy about 25% of the debt. The other 75%, but how do you get in debt? How do you keep you getting the debt to go up so you can write the bond? Notice, the Federal Reserve, which is a privately owned bank, and the banks that buy these bonds, so they put up nothing for it because they just open the bank account and back it with the bond. Do collect interest payments taken from you in the form of income taxes every single year. Or nothing. They put nothing up for. They receive 20,000 millions a year of your money. Taken now legally. But how can they take it legally? You gotta get the nation in debt. How do you get in debt? Poverty programs and war. You wanna know why we're fighting in Vietnam? Not to fight communism. To raise the debt. We've never taken care of any poverty. Poverty has never decreased or any poverty program, but debt has increased. All of our ABCs has never caused less illegitimate children. It's called more. Caused more. All of our money being poured into schools have not produced more productive people, but less productive people. Not more patriotic people, less patriotic people. Not more moral people, but less moral people. That wasn't what it was for. What it was for is debt. Now, in order to have an excuse to fight all these wars, they need communists. Lenin was financed by Jacob Schiff. Warburg, the Federal Reserve Bank, member of the CFR. Khrushchev, a few years ago, David Rockefeller, chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and of the Standard Oil Company, the number one hitman of the communists in the world, takes his vacation in the Kremlin. Is that interesting? When his vacation is over, Khrushchev is no longer premier. Now, I can't prove any connection between the two, but I'm suspicious that the boss came over and fired the branch manager. Of course, he didn't fire Rocky. A couple years ago, Nelson Rock, last year, before the Senate, he said, I believe that the wealthy of this nation owe it to our country to contribute 5 or 10% of their income in income taxes, even though they don't legally have to pay it. 5 or 10%. They say more than that to me, that dirty rotten crook. And look at Ted Bobby Kennedy in 1966 says, Nelson Rockefeller's a dirty rat. He only paid $685 in income taxes last year.
Well, that's because Bobby Kennedy paid none. All of his was in a foundation.
In fact, no Kennedy has ever paid any income tax.
No Kennedy, they've only paid the whole family property tax once in their life, and that was on the Chicago the merchandise mart. After John Kennedy was president, they paid it halfway. They wouldn't even go full rate on one building to try to look legit. The Rothschilds, who by 1850 were considered wealthier than all the royal families of the world, have never paid a tax of any sort to any government in history. Take it from the rich and give it to the poor. Isn't that what the scheme is? Huh? Every good time. Well, it's happened before. It's happened again. Thank you very much.